Dave Svinaptorp here sitting with a man who has worked for the BBC, for ESPN International, and is currently doing the Bundesliga for BT Sport. He's with the BBC. He worked with 19 different countries, and that wasn't just a pickup line. This is Mr. Derek Ray. How are you?
I'm very well, Davis. It's great to talk to you here just underneath a beautiful Curran Cathedral, very Christmassy, of course, at this time of year, and I know we've got a lot of ground to cover.
Mm-hmm. So I think the most fascinating part about your story is how diligent you are as an announcer. We know that I've read that you've read up on, you not only read up on, but you try to look as many clips as possible, especially when you were in the United States. That's how you stayed up with all of your favorite European leagues. But the fascinating thing, I think, is calling embassies. So can you tell me a little bit about that and how it started, how you got the idea to do that, to basically get the right pronunciation of some of the names that you were calling?
Well, you have to remember, first of all, that when I moved to the USA, which was in the early 90s, we were pre-internet. We weren't as technologically advanced as we are now. And it was that bit harder to get information. So, you know, nowadays you can go online and find just about anything that you need. In those days, you started with a blank sheet of paper. And I was calling games for ESPN predominantly in the United States, off tube, as we say. You know, it might be a game between, say, Ecuador and Bolivia, mm-hmm. just to give an example. And now, luckily, I was working with a few native Spanish speakers, so that would help. But say I was doing a game like Saudi Arabia against Iraq, you know, the World Cup qualifier. That's a bit more challenging linguistically. So I thought to myself, right, I want to make sure I get these pronunciations right because I do have a languages background. It means a lot to me. So I thought the best thing to do is call the embassy in Washington, D.C. So I started doing that quite regularly. And it became a bit of a standing joke amongst colleagues. They would say, "Are you calling embassies again?"
Yeah. But when you called them, did they know that it was you? Did you eventually do it so much that they knew, oh, it's just Derek Ray calling to ask about some pronunciations?
Not really, because it tended to be a different embassy every time. But it did come in very handy. I remember before the 1994 World Cup, I was given my list of games, and there were quite a few countries with languages that are not my languages. And it worked rather well. And I think it was a bit of a surprise to the PR departments and the embassies that somebody was calling for this reason. But you quickly realize that most of them liked football. You know, it is truly still the international language, and that would help break the ice. So I've done that, and I've always thought it's very important to pronounce names properly. Some people say it's not. I've had that argument even with close colleagues who seem to think that it's not that important. But from my point of view, it's one of the most significant things that we do because it's respect.
Yeah, I was going to say, because I think it's rather disrespectful, actually. I've heard a lot of, I'm from America, and I know that there's a lot of American broadcasters now trying to broadcast these games. And it seems, just disrespectful to me that they don't take the time to try to figure out, no, it's not Mario Goetze, it's Mario Goetze.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, there are now ways of doing it. So you can go online, you can punch somebody's name in, find a native speaker saying that name, and try and copy it to the best of your ability. So, it takes time, you know, but everything takes time if you mm-hmm. want to do it well. So I'll stand by those principles, and it's something that I'll never get lazy on. Yeah. And obviously when we're, you know, talking, we're here in Germany, obviously when I'm covering the Bundesliga for the World Feed or for BT Sport, I'm quite happy to say the German names with a bit of extra passion because, you know, that's always been my favorite language and something that will stay with me forever.
Is this a practice that you still employ? Do you still call embassies or do you rely mostly on the internet now?
I have called embassies. I remember I did it for a team from Belarus a few years ago that I was covering, and that was in the middle of summer. And I went online and looked around, tried to find native language commentary, couldn't find anything, went to the embassy and got the answers. But increasingly, it's much easier. It's great, actually, because you can go online now and you can see so many interviews with players, either by club media or by host broadcaster in a particular country, and you can hear the interviewer saying to the player, first of all, his name, his first name and his second name. So that does make it easier. Obviously, if it's a language like French or German or Spanish, which I certainly am not fluent in Spanish, but I speak enough Spanish and have done over the years to be able to know how to say things in that language, then it is better or easier. But, you know, you're always kept on your toes in this business.
Yeah, well, you're definitely the one that taught me how to say Kevin DeBruyne's name properly.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because there's still a debate raging about how, as English language broadcasters, we should say that.
Yeah.
But again, I stand by the fact that it's actually easier to say it the right way than it is sometimes to say it the wrong way.
Yeah.
And DeBruyne is not, I don't think, is that challenging, but there you go.
Yeah, me neither. Do you cringe when you hear the name Martinez? Because I hear that, I hear that all the time when I hear English people or English broadcasters try to say like Roberto Martinez or Javi Martinez.
I don't quite know why you can't get that one right, because you know, Martinez, is that so difficult?
Yeah,
no, it's not. I remember working with Roberto Martinez at the World Cup in Brazil, and we sort of had a little joke about that, and he's just used to hearing it said the wrong way, but. That is one that there's no excuse for, really. Mm-hmm.
Have you gotten praise from players saying, thank God that my parents have called me and heard that you say my name correctly? And have you gotten praise like that? Or
I've had one or two players over the years who have done that, who've said...
Can you name some of them?
Yeah, these are not big-name players, but there's a guy in Scotland called Farid El Alagi.
Mm-hmm.
He's been playing in Scotland for some time, and I remember I had a chat with him one night, and I said to him, is everyone getting your name correct? Because I'd never commentated on him before, and everybody in Scotland was calling him El Alagui, and he said, no, it's El Alagi. And I said, okay, so I'm going to call you El Alagi. He said thank you. He said, my father is watching. He said, I think he's in London. My father's watching. He will absolutely love that somebody gets my name right. So it's little things like that. Another guy who I've become quite friendly with, a guy in Scotland who's actually German by upbringing, although qualifies for Kosovo.
Okay.
A guy called Gramos Kurtai, who's from the northern part of Germany. And again, a few people in Scotland were calling him Kurtage, because it's T-A-J. And I just, you know, had a nice chat in German with him, and he said, no, Kurtai. So Kurtai is what I've always said. And, you know, what you find is that people don't have a lot of time, especially, you know, people who are doing multiple things in the media. So they don't always check for their pronunciations. They just say what they see.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that we should be a bit better than that.
Yeah. Was there a name that for one reason or another that you just could not pronounce?
I'm trying to think of that. There was actually one this season. It wasn't that I couldn't pronounce it, but it was very hard to say quickly. And it was in the Europa League, and it was Zorya, who were in Manchester United's group, and I was doing Zorya against Fenerbahce. And the player who scored the goal was a defensive midfield player who generally didn't get forward at all. And the trouble with it was that there were so many syllables, but with funny consonants and sh and ch sounds. And his name was Grishichkin. Grishichkin.
Oh.
Now try saying that really quickly. Grishichkin. Yeah. When the pressure is on. So I remember he'd scored. He scored an incredible goal from about 25 yards out. And I took extra time in saying that, because I knew there was the potential for that to go badly wrong.
Yeah, that's a good broadcaster instinct, just to take that extra second to make sure that you say it correctly.
No, I think that's good advice for any young broadcasters. There's never any hurry. You know, always go at your own pace. And if you do pace yourself properly, you'll get there. But it's when you dive into something thinking, oh, I've got to get all this out, and you've got all these different syllables in it. You know, it's funny, my mentor, a guy called David Francie, who was a great radio commentator in Scotland with a distinctive sound, and I got to know him, and, you know, I owe David a lot. He used to have these little vocal exercises that he recommended, and, you know, he said, what I do before a game is I say very quickly, 100 times, things like, Mixed biscuits and tea. The valiant Italians buried their valuables in a canal in the valley. He said, say that. Just say that over and over and over again, because you've got sort of difficult combinations.
Those two things are a mouthful.
Yeah, that's right. So, but if you keep practicing that, and I took his advice and did that, then you will become quite dexterous, you know, when it comes to saying things quickly. So, great advice.
Yeah. So obviously, you broadcast the Bundesliga a lot. That's one. That's the reason why you're in Germany.
Yes.
But this is, like we talked about this off, a little bit off air. This is a crossroads of two of your passions. You studied to be. You studied German at university, although I believe you didn't finish.
Yep.
But you were on a path to become a German translator. So what is it like for you to be able to announce in amounts of sport in a context that you know very well?
Well, I would say it really is the dream situation for me, and it's come quite late in my career, because it all started, as you said, I was a German language student at Aberdeen University. It was always my favourite and best subject. I seem to have an aptitude for it and a love for it. You know, I found that the language, as complicated as it was, and I never really saw it as complicated. You know, everybody else said, oh, this is such a difficult language. I just found it a liberating language, and I loved the rules. Obviously appealed to my own sort of personality.
Yeah.
The complex grammar, I found that a great challenge. I loved the sounds of the language. And it sort of went hand in hand with my football interest, because the first World Cup I can remember was 1974.
Yes.
In West Germany. And, you know, that just struck all the right chords with me. And around the same time, you got to pick a language in Scotland, either German or French. I happened to be in the class that did German. I was quite happy with that. And, you know, my interest just sort of went off the charts with it. And so I was studying German. And around that time, of course, you know, I was in my late teens when I first was in Germany a lot. I would combine it with my interest in football, so I'd try and go to as many Bundesliga grounds as I could, a lot of second division grounds, which actually in many respects I find a bit more romantic looking back.
Really?
Well, the team I still follow, even though they're not a team anybody else would follow, is a team called Hessen Kassel.
Of course.
Yeah, and they were a second division team. They were the local team to where I was based, because I was I taught in a very small Gesamtschule, a comprehensive school, right on the border of the two Germanys, as it was, west and east. And when I say right on the border, I mean, 10 metres away was the border.
Mm-hmm.
But Hessen Kassel was the local team, and I used to jump on the local train and watch them. And they were in the second division, pushing for the top flight. Never quite made it, then hit financial hard times. So there was that. But also all the, you know, obviously the Dortmunds and the Kerns and the Frankfurts and all these, you know, bigger teams. I'd go and see them as well. So it was a great education in football and in language and in culture. And I'll certainly never forget those years.
Yeah. Now, when you were in the United States, Massachusetts, obviously, to be more specific,
yes.
Was the Bundesliga one of the leagues that you were following very closely? Or is it, I mean, I'm guessing that the Scottish Premiership was definitely on the top of the list.
Well, it's interesting. We went through phases, because I was always following the Bundesliga, even though I rarely got to cover it, because ESPN never had rights to the Bundesliga while I was there. They had rights to Germany internationals. I seem to remember we had the German Cup for a little while, but we never had the Bundesliga, whereas we did have Scottish football. So I was turning my attention to that. Again, they've been the two leagues I've always followed, no matter where I've been in the world and no matter whether I've been actually working on them. But, you know, I would buy Kicker every week or have it sent to me. So things like that meant I was always close to the German game, and obviously having the language ability was a huge advantage, because there was a long period where unless you spoke German, it was quite hard to find, you know, credible information. That's all changed, and you know, all the teams have great English language sites. There are terrific blogs and podcasts, as you know well too, which are extremely well informed. So German football is something that's always been there, but it's only in the last few years. Really, when I went back to live in the UK, 2009, ESPN UK had the rights to the Bundesliga, so
I
would
remember
do quite
that.
A lot of do quite a lot of games for them, and obviously now with BT Sports and with the world feed for the Bundesliga itself, so it's now become a very big part of what I do professionally.
What so is Where does the season rank in terms of the crazy meter of all the seasons that you've seen of the Bundesliga?
It's one of the wildest, I'd have to say. It's one of the craziest. And for the life of me, I don't know how we predict scores in the Bundesliga anymore.
I mean, we're recording this before the big Bayern-Leipzig game Wednesday. That game would probably... Nobody thought it would be as important as it was.
No, I mean, I think when we saw the schedule when it came out, we thought, okay, that's interesting. That's going to be a fun way to end the calendar year. But it's almost as though there was divine intervention, as though somebody up there knew that this was going to be the decider in terms of the Herbstmeisterschaft, you know, the championship for the first part of the season. So I think, so many shocks and surprises. And where does this all end?
Yeah.
Now, Bayern obviously are still the favourites and will feel that they should go on and win it. But, you know, they're not having it all their own way. And, you know, the likes of Leverkusen and Gladbach, you know, teams who we all thought might actually make a bit of a challenge and might get closer to Bayern this season, going the other way. And then you have Hoffenheim and Köln and so many other surprises. And then just week to week, you know, Ingolstadt beating Leipzig and Leverkusen in back-to-back rounds. It's been one of the most memorable. We have to wait, I think, to see, you know, obviously wait to the end of the season to put it into proper historical context. You know, when you think back to Kaiserslautern.
I think Kaiserslautern winning promotion is the name that people ought to think
of. I mean, I think that one will take some beating. It's gone a different way in recent years. I mean, I remember following the Bundesliga, and you never quite knew who was going to win the title season in, season out. Bayern were always up there, but they rarely won it sort of two or three years in a row.
Yeah. Last year was the first time that they did it 4 years in a row.
Exactly. You know, you always had competition from other teams. And, you know, Werder Bremen, I remember being a very strong side when I was, first interested in the Bundesliga in the 80s. Hamburg, of course, in the early 80s, but they've, as we know, that's a story in itself. You had your Stuttgart. All these clubs would have a part to play in the story.
Yeah.
And that's happening this season, and I think the league is better for it.
Do you think that the Bundesliga still has a lot of intriguing characters? Because last year they had Pep Guardiola. A few years ago they had Jurgen Klopp. A lot of their big players have obviously gone abroad to the Premier League specifically. Do you think that the Bundesliga still has, in terms of a broadcasting point of view, do you think that they still have a lot of exciting characters that make you, like, gets you into the booth every week?
Yeah, I think so. I think every team. We're talking just after, the weekend round before Christmas, and I had the privilege of covering Mainz and Hamburg on Saturday. Somebody like Dani Latza, who's been injured for most of the season, never scored a goal in the Bundesliga, and then he goes and scores 3 goals in one game, all outside the box. It was almost as though every time he touched the ball, he was rifling the ball into the back of the net. So you have these stories. I think that the stories are more to do with the style of football and the younger players coming through, and also the coaching, because I think the coaches now tend to be a bit younger and more dynamic. You have exceptions like Ancelotti, but Thomas Tuchel,
Nagelsmann, of course, being the best example,
yeah,
I think.
The extreme example of that, somebody who's young and certainly innovative. And, I think we're going to see more and more of that. We're going to see coaches who are good, given their chance at a young age. Pal Dardai, somebody who I always enjoy listening to, and I think his quotes are terrific. Ralf Hasenhüttl at Leipzig, I think, is very engaging and honest. And I think he's been a great addition to the upper reaches of the league, having previously served his time at Ingolstadt. So I think the characters are there, Davis, I do. I think the German players obviously play a big part of it, but the overseas players too. And the clubs do a fine job of marketing the league and of making it sing. And I think it just goes from strength to strength.
How is we've talked a little bit about this before. How has the Bundesliga improved in your eyes? Because you've obviously followed it, but now you're right there broadcasting it and for a BT Sport, an international broadcaster.
Yeah, I think it's... has it improved in recent years in comparison with other leagues? I'm not sure. I think it's always been strong, but I think it's constantly evolving. And I think it's evolving in terms of young players. I mean, every club has young players, just about. And that is an unavoidable part of it. That's part of the day-to-day business plan. I think that they still, here in Germany, they still have a structure to what they do that doesn't necessarily exist elsewhere. And I'm thinking particularly of England, where it does seem to me that there are exceptions to this, but at most clubs, it's a scattergun approach.
Mm-hmm.
They have all the money. They are the richest clubs in the world. And it's almost as though they say, right, we can just throw it around here. We can make a few mistakes and it doesn't much matter. Can't really do that in Germany. You've got to be more exact about what you do. If you make mistakes on the transfer front, you'll pay the penalty very quickly. So I think there's more judicious decision-making in Germany. And ultimately, it makes the clubs that bit fitter. Because they're not just, you know, willy-nilly throwing money around and seeing what happens, like throwing darts against a board and seeing if one of them stick. So I think that is always going to be good. Obviously, Bayern are at the top of the tree financially, and that is not going to change. But you have the contrast with what other clubs do. Dortmund, of course, do it their way. Leipzig are trying it a different way. I know that they're not loved by everyone. But, you know, underpinning their approach is this commitment to youth and signing good young players and coaching them the right way and having all the young players, the youth teams, train with the first team. That's one of the things that Leipzig do. They're not siphoned off the first team. They're all doing it together and singing from the same hymn sheet. So it's a balance and it's different from club to club, but I think that makes it interesting.
Now, the Bundesliga is known as being the league for the fans. I mean, their club structures are designed that way. That must make for a really great audio track when you are doing your broadcast, when you go into the stadiums. Is it some of the best stadium atmospheres you've experienced?
Oh, I think the Bundesliga is very hard to top for atmosphere. I'll say to anybody who wants to listen that if you want atmosphere, come here to Germany. There are a few places better. I mean, yeah, you can.
Are there places better?
Well, what I would say is, you know, I've done games in Turkey. I've been to games in Argentina. Now, they are special, you know, Boca River, for example, in Argentina, Galatasaray, Fenerbahce, crazy, you know, absolutely, you know, off the charts. But I think consistently, week to week, the atmosphere is the best in Germany. And I think, you know, Dortmund is the one that most people would point to as being extra special. And I'd probably go along with that. I don't think there's anything quite like Dortmund. Schalke, for example, I was lucky enough to commentate on that one very recently.
Yeah, Schalke's very underrated, I think.
Yeah, no, I think so too. And they make it, and that was part of it in that game, was that the Schalke fans, 7,000 of them in that little corner, including their chairman, Clemens Tönnies, they made a right old racket, and there was a bit of a competition going on back and forth between the two. So I think the atmosphere, wherever you go, it's got its own feel, its own vibe. It seems somehow less corporate than in England. I'm not saying that it's always corporate in England. There are still grounds there that can offer atmosphere, but I think you'd be hard-pressed and you'd be lying if you said that the atmosphere is better in England than it is in Germany.
What's the stadium that when you get assigned a game, you're like, oh, I'm so happy I get to go back here?
It would be Dortmund.
Dortmund, okay.
Yeah, it would be. I mean, I've been lucky enough to be there twice for games this season. And, Dortmund is a winner. Just when you walk into it, the way that the stands are shaped, that Südtribüne behind the goal where you know, 20...
It really looks like a wall. It looks like a wall of people.
Yeah, I mean, 24,000 people in that yellow wall.
Yeah, I know that some people who follow it overseas, they can't really get a... It's hard to even describe because it's literally... It looks like a wall.
Yeah, no, it's a special place. And, you know, I think it's a cathedral of football. I think it's something that everybody should experience if they get the chance. And, I speak to a lot of people who do make the pilgrimage to Dortmund for a game. They're not necessarily Dortmund fans, and they all come away saying, I'm so glad I did that. Mm. So that is right up there at the very top for me. I would have to say other grounds, other cities that I enjoy. Köln is one, you know. I think it's maybe slightly underrated.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing quite like the anthem that they play before the games at Köln, which has actually a Scottish root, of course, from the old Loch Lomond song. But Die Hörner have made it their own, which is quite right. And really, there aren't many weak stadia for atmosphere in Germany. Allianz Arena has its own feel. I wouldn't say quite as loud as Dortmund, but still, you know, a proper football crowd and a great viewing stadium. I think there are very few bad seats. Whoever designed the Allianz Arena did a great job.
Now, you've covered the Eredivisie, you've covered the league in Brazil, you've covered a number of leagues. Is there a style of football that speaks to you the most?
The style of football that speaks to me the most, again, it's going to sound as though, because we're here in Germany, that we're extolling the virtues of all things German. But I think the German style has always been the one that has spoken to me the most. Now, what's interesting is that the German style has evolved. You know, when I first started watching German football, going back to the late 70s, early 80s, you know, properly, it was a more direct style. It was sort of a marriage almost of continental values and English football. I think it's become ever more technical in the last few years, and I think we've all enjoyed that development. And of course, you know, German football had to go more technical because they realised around 2000 that what they were doing wasn't modern enough, that it wasn't going to take German football to the level that it needed to be at.
Well, do you think that the bigger influx of foreign players has changed the style? Because you see players coming in like Douglas Costa, very, very good technically.
Yeah.
May not have the sharp passing that German football is somewhat known for. Do you think that the players that have come in, do you think that they have forced Germany to change their style?
I think they've helped. I think that you know, there's obviously competition for places, and every team is going to have overseas players, and you're generally going to bring overseas players in who are technicians. You know, I think that makes most sense. Again, some teams are not quite as well disposed to do that as others. But I think what you're seeing now is you're seeing a commitment at the grassroots level to a high technical level of football. And they did have to change. And I think it's the one thing that is most impressive about German football is that all the clubs bought into this. If you try to do this in England, or even, dare I say it, in my little country, Scotland, you wouldn't get very far. Mm-hmm. Because everybody has their own agenda. Everybody wants to do it their way. What is important for one club is not for another. And people will say, well, why do I care about developing players for the national team? In Germany, they realise that underpinning the success of the whole thing is the national team. And, you know, the national team is a great advert for German football as a whole, because I think most people, whether they, you know, whether they support Germany or not, they admire the German national team. They watch it and they go, they are good to watch. Stylistically now, they're much better to watch than they were 20 years ago. And they're technically excellent. So it's the one thing that unites all the clubs. They do want to produce players for the national team because they recognise that one reflects well on the other, Bundesliga and Nationalmannschaft.
How close are you following Oliver Burke's career?
Very. with great interest. And I wish him well. And I'm delighted he made the move that he did. Now, there were many voices in, not so much in Scotland, but in England.
In England, I think,
who somehow...
A lot of former players say, why would you go to Germany when you can definitely get a job in England here?
Short-sighted. Yeah. You know, I mean, I don't know who was advising Oliver Burke on this or whether he realised this himself, but obviously he looked at RB Leipzig. Now, as I said, not everybody loves what Leipzig are doing, but I'll tell you what they are doing well is bringing on young players, and they've got the best people to do that. Ralf Rangnick is an expert when it comes to that particular field. So signing players of that age group and making them better, he's gone to the right club. And the thing about Burke is he's clearly not the finished article yet, and Leipzig can see that he's not, but there's enough raw material there for them to work with, and they're giving him a chance in most games as a late substitute, and his time will come.
Yeah.
But I think it was a terrific move. I mean, you know, suppose he had gone to a big English club and been loaned out to a championship side. What good would that have done him? Would that have differentiated him from anyone else in his age group who's either Scottish or English? I don't think so.
Yeah.
So for me, I hope that people will look at what Oliver Burke has done and think to themselves, Why confine ourselves to these shores, meaning the UK?
Yeah, the two Scotsmen that I work with, Ross and Stefan, they definitely would definitely would agree with you. And it's funny because I think they most, I bet they, like Oliver Burke, it's a good percentage of their tweets now. Is that the same with you, that you have been following that closely?
Well, obviously, I have a lot of followers on Twitter who are Scots.
Yeah, so that too.
Whenever I put a tweet out about Leipzig, inevitably the response is, how's Oliver Burke doing, Derek?
Of course.
Does Oliver Burke, did Oliver Burke play at the weekend?
Yes.
And if ever I tweet something about Oliver Burke in particular, that does get most responses. So I'm trying to get, one of my goals on Twitter is to try to get many of my fellow countrymen interested in German football as a whole, and I do realize that it's much easier to do that when they have somebody they can relate to, just as it is with Americans. I tweet a lot with Americans, and it's often on the subject of, has been recently, Bobby Wood, for example, who scored a good goal. I covered that game at the weekend with Mainz Hamburg. So it sometimes does need that peg to hang the thing on.
Well, that's an interesting point, because I think that there's actually a lot of interest in the Bundesliga simply because that there's Americans playing it, not just Bobby Wood, but obviously I think Christian Pulisic is the biggest one. Do you think that could happen with Scotland if Oliver Burke stays there for maybe 5 or 7 years?
Well, I would really hope so. I think it's more difficult to imagine that, just because it's easier for a footballer in Scotland to stay in the UK. I think this is why I quite admire Americans and Australians, because when it comes to football, because they have always known that they're going to have to go to a far-flung place. You know, yeah, you could play in MLS, and some have, and a lot of very good players have spent their whole career in MLS. But if you really want to test yourself, you've got
to cross an ocean.
That's right. Whereas, you know, you can be a good player from Scotland, and you know, there's a lot of money to go and play in the Championship in England, and you can think that's a pretty worthy goal, and I'd only have to move 2 or 3 hours from your home, and have access to getting back whenever you want, really. So that's why I think it's more difficult, because you have to almost say to young players, for your career, it's better that you try something different. And we have very few examples of players who actually have done that. There are one or two. There's a young guy called Ryan Gold who went to Portugal at a young age and is still trying to make his way, very technically gifted. And because he hasn't quite made his way, a lot of people say, oh, he should just have stayed, he should have gone to an English club. But I think that may work for some people, but it's the lazy approach to say it all the time. You just aspire to going south of the border. There's a big football world out there.
Now, as someone in the media, I think we have this... We have this almost this responsibility, not responsibility is the right word, but this encouragement to get rid of all of our biases. Are there teams that you root for still, or is it, have you broadcast so long that it's gotten to the point where you just love football no matter who plays it and who's on each side of the field?
It's the latter, really, because the job is to be a commentator, not to be a cheerleader for any particular team.
Obviously, when you're broadcasting, I think you have to stay unbiased. But in privately, do you still do you have a certain team or a certain? I'm guessing you're a Scotland fan. But.
Well, that's right. I mean, when and even, you know, I have had the privilege of broadcasting the Scottish national team on a few occasions. Not that often, because the companies that I've worked for have never really had rights to national team games. But when Scotland play England, for example, STV, which is the commercial broadcaster, free-to-air broadcaster in Scotland, they very kindly asked me to do their games, did the Scotland-England game recently. And I'm broadcasting to a Scottish audience, so I'm not going there as an out-and-out cheerleader. But obviously, I'm tailoring my comments to the Scottish market, you know, so that they're more interested in what Scott Brown is doing than they are in what Wayne Rooney is doing, you know. So obviously that's how you would pitch it. But I'm not going there saying, you know, oh, Scotland have been cheated, or this is ridiculous, or whatever. But I'm definitely aware of who I'm talking to. Bias? No, I mean, if I'm watching a game, for example, I'm from Aberdeen. There are days, if I'm not working, I might go and watch Aberdeen with some friends, and I might go and sit in the stand. And you know, because I'm from Aberdeen, I might hope that they win. But it's not a rabid kind of fervent feeling, you know. And I think when you're in the media, and I think when you're working day in, day out, you can't really feel that way. And it is far more important, and has always been since I took up professional commentating, it's always been more important that the game comes to life and that you sell the game. And I you know, for example, in the Bundesliga, I don't really have a top-flight Bundesliga team that I would say I support.
Yeah, some people have teams in like every single country.
No, I've never.
In my opinion, if you support a team, that kind of closes you off to basically everything that the league can offer. Do you feel the same way, or is it?
Well, I understand. For example, when I was in America, I found that young fans who were discovering the sport, they would very quickly adopt a team in every country. Mm-hmm. I understand why they do that, because it was a way of creating an interest for themselves. And I actually have played this game on Twitter with American fans. I've said, you know, do you want to find a Scottish team to support? I'll get some Scottish fans to persuade you that they should, and then it becomes quite a fun little competition.
Yeah.
And at the end of it, the American fan will say, "Yeah, I'm now a Partick Thistle supporter, or I'm now a Hearts supporter, or whatever." So that's been enjoyable. But I understand why people in America do it, because they were looking for a connection, because they will have grown up. Many of them will have grown up even before MLS or even the early years of MLS, but looking for something more. And so the obvious way to do that is to say, I'm a Crystal Palace fan or in England, or I'm a Hamburg fan in Germany, or whatever. So, yeah, I mean, I can see why people do it. But I think at the end of the day, it is hard to have loyalties in multiple directions.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you a little bit about now your broadcasting, because I think there's a lot of broadcasters out there that are listening that want to hear what you have to say. I think the biggest question I have is your voice is very, it's not like the, I mean, I have a sick voice right now, but it's, but when people think of, you see, hear a lot of American broadcasters with these deep, these baritone voices. Did you develop your voice in when you were broadcasting, or have you always just used your own and people can either take it or leave it?
Well, I've always tried to be who I am in terms of my personality, in terms of my use of words and language. I wouldn't know if I have a, you know, classic broadcasting voice or anything. I'm not sure. Hopefully it's a clear one. Hopefully it's one that stands out. You know, there was a TV producer told me many years ago, he said, the one thing you've got going for you, he said, over your competition, is that when you are on the air, I know straight away it's you. He said, you don't sound like anyone else particularly. You've got your own style, you've got your own sound. And he said, there are many other commentators who are excellent, but I can't always tell them apart. That may be because I'm Scottish, although I don't have a pronounced Scottish accent.
The accent might have helped.
Yeah, that might help. But I think it's also just how you accentuate. And I do think this. I think what I would say to young broadcasters is that the voice is very important. It doesn't mean that you do things artificially, but you have to look after the voice. And for example, you're saying that you've been under the weather the last few days. You know, that happens to all of us throughout the season.
What do you do when you're under the weather?
You have to be. It's actually the commentator's worst nightmare, because there are times when
you lose your voice.
Well, you're barely broadcastable, and you have to use techniques. And of course, you're not feeling well. It's the last time you want to be thinking about anything like that. But you use techniques to cover the fact that you can't always hit the high note or hit the low note or whatever. So that is a constant worry. And unfortunately, it goes with the territory. You do your best to get through everything. Touch wood, I haven't had to call off games for a while. But there are times when sometimes you do. Sometimes you don't have the voice to be able to do it. And the other thing I will say is that you know, the job may sound glamorous, and it's a wonderful job, don't get me wrong, but you do have to treat the voice as your instrument. Mm-hmm. And when your friends are out having a great time on a Friday night, you know, having a couple of drinks, shouting in a loud bar, if you decide to do that, then you're dicing with danger. Mm-hmm. Because the voice needs to be protected at all times. So you might be home resting and preparing while they're having a good time.
How do you protect your voice? What are the techniques that you use to protect your voice?
I think you have to be very careful about shouting in loud bars, because people think as a commentator you shout, but actually you don't.
No.
You project and you speak from, well, the diaphragm, as they say. That's being very technical about it. You speak.
Yeah, he's expanding his stomach as he's telling me this.
Yeah. So that if you, you know, I find even that I, if I'm going out for, say, a bite to eat with some colleagues and it's a loud atmosphere, I will get very quiet, because the last thing you want to be doing is you know, shouting. That's misusing your voice.
Yeah.
And so even though a commentator might sound as though he's being very, you know, animated and excited, it's all done within a contained environment. It's done, hopefully, in a way that protects your voice, because the job is not just shouting and screaming. You know, if you put a fan on there with a microphone and he started shouting and screaming, he would lose his voice almost straight away. You listen to fans after a game, many of them have lost their voice, mm-hmm. or even managers, you'll hear them, they've lost their voice because they've been shouting so much.
I think the biggest example I can think of is, well, not, maybe not in terms of football, but I don't know if you follow basketball, but Doc Rivers, who's the coach of the Los Angeles Clippers. I think he's the... probably the most famous one, because he must have been born with just, like, harmed vocal cords, because whenever you hear him talk, he's already lost his voice.
Yeah, that's right. So I mean, that is an important part of it. And it depends, obviously, you know, if you're only doing one game a week, you have some recovery time, but I'm not in that position. I generally do 3-4 games a week, so I've constantly got to be thinking about that. And as always, the best medicine is right behind us here, a bottle of water. You know, you can't beat water. And I always say that to myself after a game where maybe I have been pressing it hard. Water, water, water. Just drink water. And you know, I'll do that maybe too much, but not sure that you actually can do that too much.
Obviously, broadcasting for TV and radio is very, very different. But there is some overlap. Is there points when you're broadcasting on TV where you're saying, oh, I'm saying too much, I just need to let the play... because I believe that's your background, is radio.
Yeah.
So was that a hard transition for you to make, to go from radio to television?
Initially, very hard. And I had to make that transition within the first few months of my professional broadcasting career. I started on radio, and I'd always wanted to be a radio commentator. I was interested in television commentary, but I hadn't quite... developed a love for TV commentary as a young broadcaster. It was always the radio that I idolised. And I think that's because radio commentators are more involved in the game than TV commentators. If you're doing TV commentary well, you do need to step back from it a little bit. But there are definitely times when I'll watch a game back and I'll think to myself, you said a little bit too much there. We'll rarely go the other way and think that I said too little. And I think that is, again, something I would pass on to every broadcaster.
One of the less is more arguments.
Absolutely. Fans will rarely say you didn't say enough there, but they will be very quick to tell you guys spoke far too much.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's something that's creeping more and more into modern broadcasting. I think it's becoming more wall-to-wall. And my view is we need to guard against that a little bit. I think timing is important. I think finding the right words at the right time is what it's all about, not just talking, 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 talking.
Now, I've heard you broadcast games by yourself, and I've heard you broadcast games with a partner. Is there a style that you prefer?
No, I enjoy both. I enjoy the rapport.
Because they're very different. I mean, you have to be a little bit more engaging, if I'm correct.
Yep.
You have to be more engaging when you have a partner, and you can maybe talk more about the tactics than just the narratives.
Well, I think that when you have a partner, you need to have a chemistry with that partner. But at the same time, you need to remember that the stars during the game are on the pitch, not in the
booth,
in the commentary box or broadcast booth. And not everybody realizes that. So I think that is something that you have to take into it, that we are there to enhance the viewing experience. Doesn't mean over-talking. It means being a soundtrack that complements the action. I always think it's a bit like a referee. If you notice the referee too much, then maybe he's... not having a great game. If he just sort of blends in with the game and you hardly, you know, are aware that he's there, probably a good thing. And I think that about commentary too. So
just in comparison.
Yeah. So if you're working alone, it's different. In some ways, it's easier because you actually then can pace according to your own sense of timing. You know, there's no danger of you talking over the other guy, because there is no other guy. So you have time, and you have time to be able to look at everything. And again, if I would say to young broadcasters, if you are working on your own, take your time. You know, don't feel you have to dive into everything. Take a couple of seconds, pause, punctuate, Have a little chuckle about something. I often do that. Have a little chuckle to myself if I see something funny.
Well, I think one of the interesting things that I read in one of the interviews that you did was you broadcast to basically one person.
Yes.
And you know somebody that's watching in the audience, and you broadcast to that person. That's very interesting.
That goes back to a lot of the old cricket commentators in the 50s and 60s. That was their advice. That was how they saw their job. And that very much appealed to me. And I tend to do that. I'll tend to, in every game, I'll focus in on somebody who I know is watching, and it might be my father,
yeah.
It might be a good friend, it might be somebody who I met the week before who definitely was going to watch. And I think, right, I'm talking to that person. Because you think about it, if you're talking to one person, it's going to be more intimate, it's hopefully going to be more informative, it's going to be hopefully a better tone than if you're broadcasting to the masses, you know, sort of thing. So you just think about talking to that one person. And yeah, I've never deviated from that.
Do you find that football is better on TV or on radio?
What a question. I would accept that football can seem more exciting on the radio, and that's because radio is the theatre of the mind. And as the commentator, it's your job to paint evocative pictures. And dare I say it, you have a bit of artistic license when you do that. You can exaggerate. Almost never seems like a bad game on the radio. Whereas on TV, it's there, warts and all. So you can't fool the TV audience as much. Not saying that you fool any audience.
You should, yeah.
No, but on radio, you can make it more upbeat. And radio pictures are still very powerful. Radio commentary done well is a wonderful art. No, I haven't done it. I haven't done radio commentary for 20 years. You know, so if I were to go back and do it, I think I could do it, but there would be another transition.
Yeah.
It would. I mean, I don't think it would take me too long, and I don't think I would be doing it at the highest level of my ability initially. But it's an art, and I will say radio and TV commentary they're not siblings; they're more like distant cousins.
Yeah.
Because in TV, yeah, you want to be able to capture the moment and find the right words, but a lot of the time, it is knowing about when you should have silence and when you let the crowd, speak for itself. So, TV has been my life for almost all my professional career. So I'm probably going to say that TV wins. But there's part of me that remains a radio lover, and that will always be so.
Not every game can be exciting that you call. Are there times where you're just sitting there and you're thinking, man, how do I make this game interesting?
Oh yeah.
So how do you get through that? Is there like a moment that you try to find how do you get through that? I can't even imagine how one would get through that.
Well, I think you've got to be honest, because if you're watching at home, you'll be going through the same thing. You'll be saying, this is a terrible game. You know, this is awful. But I think you come up with words that sum up the situation. And I think you've got to guard against being overly critical. I think you can't go in and just say, this is absolute rubbish, and why would you want to watch this? You find something to talk about that might be interesting. And I tend to look for a little bit of light humour. Again, humour for me is something that can be on the periphery of it. It can be there, but should never overtake what is happening on the pitch. But yeah, you'll find a light moment, and the director can help you there by cutting a shot that might allow for a little chuckle about something. But I think you just got to stick to your game plan, because a commentator has a game plan going in. You research certain things, you want to talk about certain things. You might not get them all in. Sometimes a bad game is where you can get more of the factoids in. When it's a good game, I often say to people, I might research, you know, for days and days and days. I'm lucky if I get 2 or 3% of the material that I researched into the match, because it's that good. You know, the game is just so fluent, there's no need for the extraneous stuff. It's in a bad game where you're tested with all the stuff that you've prepped.
Yeah. Now, you broadcasting the Bundesliga, you get to actually go to the stadiums. Now, you that wasn't always your broadcasting career. You went to ESPN, you would be, when you were working in Bristol, you were in a booth and you had the games on television. Now, do you see a harm in television's stations settling with just the booth view, or do you think that they can still replicate the same experience for the viewer?
Well, it's never going to be exactly the same, but you can understand why it happens. I mean, if you think about it, Davis, you know, all over the world, you have stations covering football, you know, from different countries. And if every channel wanted to send a commentator, you wouldn't be spectators.
There wouldn't be fans.
There wouldn't be fans. So I think it is understandable. As a commentator, you obviously want to be at the game. There's no substitute for that. But you recognise that it can't happen all the time. And you certainly, you know, would have to recognise that when I was at ESPN, you know, there were games on the television for the international audience every day. So it wouldn't really have been practical to be sending people, because it is quite a big technical exercise to do that. People sort of think, well, isn't it just a sort of set a commentator down and let him talk? But there's a lot more to it than that, with wires and trucks and sound circuits. And there's an expense involved in that as well. So, what I do think is when you call games off a monitor, I think you develop a sixth sense for what's actually happening off the ball, because you sort of train yourself to think, right, okay, I'm seeing this little picture, but I can tell by his body language that so-and-so is making the run off the left. And so it's little things that you maybe wouldn't think about if you only ever did games from sight. So I actually feel quite blessed to have done as many games off the monitor as I have.
Has it changed your view of football because you've had to develop this sixth sense?
I'm not sure, but I think it's served me quite well. I think that somebody paid me a compliment once. They said, I can never tell if you're at the game or if you're off tube. And I said, well,
I can't tell. I can't tell.
That's, if you say that makes me really happy, because one of the things that I always do is I try to put myself in the stadium, whether I'm there or not. And what I do is I turn the crowd noise up to the maximum. So I'm fighting it. And I'd say that to any co-commentator I'm working with in a studio. Turn that crowd up, because you don't want to sound as though you're in a studio. You want to make it feel as though you are actually at the venue. And so that's a technique that you can use to lift yourself. And so, yeah, if somebody does think that, I mean, there'll be times when sometimes the audio mix is just low. Maybe the feed coming in from the stadium is not that high and the sound man can do little about that. But for the most part, it's not that difficult to get the balance right. And hopefully the commentator can play a part in that by making it seem as though we're there, whether we're there or not.
If you weren't broadcasting football, what sport would you be broadcasting? Or is football just so ingrained into your life that you couldn't even think of another sport that you would be able to do?
It would be hard to imagine doing anything else. The only other sports I've really dabbled in have been golf and tennis. And golf is something I've always enjoyed, but I'm not sure that golf broadcasting would necessarily have suited me. Different pace, different rhythm. Tennis I've done, and again, that's a sport with its own dynamic. It would be hard to imagine. It would be hard to imagine life without football, because, I've enjoyed it through the prism of broadcasting. I've enjoyed it through the prism of being at games, of meeting players and managers and getting to hear their stories and trying to relay those stories on the air in a way that's relatable from the viewer's point of view. So another sport, I don't know. There are times when I thought it would be fun to try, but you know, I'm going to turn 50 next year, and you know, I've been doing this a while, so I'm not sure that is in the future.
That's not part of your midlife crisis feeling. No,
no, no, not at
just
all.
Just get away from football. No.
I don't think there's any part of me that wants to get away from football at all. And you know, it has been a great pleasure, and I just hope I can do it for a few more years.
Do you still have broadcasting goals? Because, I mean, you've broadcast World Cups, you've broadcast a Champions League final. What else is there that you haven't seen yet that you would like to see?
I think the one of the things I would like to do is I would like to do a World Cup and go towards the end of the World Cup, because I've never managed to do that. You know, I've worked at just about every World Cup that's been on since I, you know, turned professional. But my involvement tends to be, end of the group stage or early knockout rounds. So I've never commentated on a World Cup semi-final, never commentated on a World Cup final. And, you know, that's the luck of the draw. And it's a very competitive business, and there's a lot of very good commentators who are vying for the same thing. So, as you said, I've been lucky enough to do Champions League final on multiple occasions. Those were great years at ESPN, and it still means a lot to me when Americans say those were the times that got me into the sport of football. And, you know, that really does mean a hell of a lot to me. But, yeah, the World Cup would be something. To be able to say I've done a World Cup final, and, you know, probably the odds are against it at this point, but to be able to do that would be a challenge I would really relish.
Well, Mr. Ray, this has been a real, real pleasure to talk to you, and I'm sure it has been for our Tribune podcast listeners as well. So thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure, and let's do it again sometime. Maybe we can go specifically into the Bundesliga in a future edition.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll have to talk it over, but for sure. I'm very honored that I got to talk to you, and I'm sure that a lot of the listeners were very honored that you took the time to do this. So thank you.
Thank you, Davis.